Hi, this is Scott McNamara. Today I'm going to talk about plea bargaining. Oftentimes people criticize the prosecutors. Recently I received a phone call where someone was basically saying that we're lazy or incompetent. Very common when people talk about plea bargaining that don't understand the system to place criticism on prosecutors for either being weak, lazy, or incompetent. And in reality, that's not accurate. So I figured I would just do this podcast to try to explain plea bargaining and why we do it and how it works. But before I talk about plea bargaining, what I would like to talk about is just the mere fact that our system, our criminal justice system, was built around the fact that we would plea bargain. And when people step back and think about it, especially the critics of plea bargaining, they would quickly realize that if we did not plea bargain, our system would come to a screeching halt because we do not have enough judges or courtrooms to try every single case that comes before the court. Just traffic tickets alone would bring the system to a screeching halt if we did not plea bargain traffic tickets. So within the system itself and the way our system was built, we see how the system itself was built around plea bargaining in the fact that we're trying to get to a fair and just decision, not a win-at-all-cost, take-no-prisoners approach. And one of the other things, too, that would happen if we didn't plea bargain is we would have police officers spending more time in the courtroom than on the streets. So let's talk about prosecutorial discretion, because to understand plea bargaining, we have to understand that a prosecutor has the discretion to plea bargain. It's one of the things that's built into the system, and it's called prosecutorial discretion. So a prosecutor and myself, the elected district attorney or an assistant district attorney, what we have is the discretion to prosecute or to not prosecute any case that we so decide. We do not have to blindly prosecute every case that comes before us. So the fact that the police arrest somebody, that doesn't mean we just go into courtroom and fight and try our best to prove what the police charge the person to be. So for instance, let's say if we get a case where we look at it and it looks initially the police, when they made an arrest, it looks like it's a robbery, but when we look into it deeper, we realize that either there wasn't a weapon involved or there was not force involved, maybe it was a drug deal gone bad, that changes everything. So we do not have to blindly prosecute the cases. Ethically, we actually are prohibited from doing that. So let's just talk a little bit about what we do with our prosecutorial discretion. DAs, myself, many DAs throughout the state, many assistants throughout the state do it. Number one, we might refuse to prosecute a case if we thought that the prosecution would be unfair or unjust. We divert cases. So, for instance, when we have younger people, or we in Oneida County, for instance, we have veterans diversion program. There's certain groups of people that we will try to keep out of the criminal justice system. Generally, those people are people that it's their first brush with the system, or that we believe that there's something going on that we could address and try to remedy so that we do not see that person in the future. And that happens a lot with alcohol or drug abuse. Now, I touched upon it a little bit earlier, but let's talk about ethics at this point. Prosecutors are prohibited by our ethical rules from prosecuting a case that we do not believe that there is probable cause to support that charge. That's the baseline of what the ethics requires. But in reality, most prosecutors don't prosecute a case unless they believe they can win the case. So in essence, they believe that there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you think about that ethical rule, it makes a lot of sense, because prosecutors, as we're often accused, we have all this power, and you know, there's a lot of people criticizing prosecutors saying that we draconian, that we misuse our power. In reality, the vast majority of prosecutors, like any profession, do their job the best they can. Are there people that make mistakes or people that do things wrong? Absolutely, as with any profession. But generally speaking, prosecutors are very ethical people, and they have incredible ethical rules dictating what they can and can't do, and they're supervised not only by a grievance committee, but by courts and actually the public, because if an office is not doing what they should be doing or violating their ethical rules or being heavy-handed, oftentimes that DA is voted out of office. So when it comes to prosecuting a case, the prosecutor has to ethically believe there's probable cause to support the charge. And like I said, the vast majority of prosecutors don't move forward unless they believe they can win the case, which would mean they believe that there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So let's get to the heart of plea bargaining. The way I look at it, there's actually six types of plea bargaining situations. So, for example, let's just start off with number one, and I'll go from the least when we prosecute something to the least to the most. Obviously, the least is when we don't prosecute somebody. So let's just talk about that. There are many times where we'll look at a case and we will not prosecute it. We will decline prosecution. That typically happens when we do not have evidence to support going forward. We might think we know who did it. The public might think they know who did it. But there's just no evidence to support a prosecution. You know, probably the most famous case that most of us are aware of is the JonBenet Ramsey case. There's never been a prosecution. There's a lot of different theories on who did it, but there's not enough evidence for anyone to be charged or for anyone to be prosecuted on that. So we decline prosecution. We do not move forward. The next type of plea bargaining or prosecution decision that we make is what I call the gratuitous plea bargain. And that's the one that I think a lot of people, when they're yelling at prosecutors or people that are trying to run against the sitting prosecutor saying, oh, they plea bargain everything, that's the one that they're attacking. But if people take a step back and think about what they're talking about, they quickly say, oh, well, wait a second. I wouldn't want prosecutors not to do that, not to gratuitously reduce something down, because the one type of case that we do that the most in is vehicle and traffic cases. It's the type of case that most people come into contact with the criminal justice system. A traffic infraction, speeding, fail to completely stop for a stop sign. Most people, when they get a speeding ticket, want to be able to come to their prosecutor and say, hey, listen, I've never got a ticket before in my life. This is the first time I ever got pulled over by the police. Is there anything you can do? I don't want my insurance to go up. Now, in those cases, generally speaking, there is nothing that would require a prosecutor to reduce it. And in most of those cases, generally speaking, those are pretty easy cases to win. And we could just prosecute them, say, no reduction, no, it's your problem. You got charged, you're getting... you're going to get convicted of the ticket. But we don't. We typically try to look at it. We take into consideration driving history, the speed, and depending on what type of ticket is, any other factor that would come into play. And oftentimes we do reduce those tickets down. And generally speaking, people are happy that we reduce those tickets down when they're the recipient of that vehicle and traffic violation. In larger cases, that generally doesn't happen. When you're talking about major felonies, violent felonies, that's not a type of plea bargaining that goes on. We're just doing it out of the kindness of our heart. There's no reason for us to do it. That's generally not the underlying reason for a reduction when people see that. The second type of plea bargaining, or second type of plea bargaining, is when we're doing it to be fair. So, for instance, there are times when you will have a case where the facts are very strong and you just believe that to be fair, it would be fair to reduce the case down. So, for instance, let's say you have a case where it's not really self-defense, but you can understand why the person did what they did, and you would say, well, I can understand why they did what they did, and so therefore to prosecute them to the full extent of the law might not be fair. A perfect example is a domestic violence situation. If you have a long history of domestic violence and a husband or a boyfriend has abused his girlfriend for a significant period of time, and then there comes a time when the victim does something in retaliation. So let's say, for example, they destroy property or they they assault their perpetrator before they can assault them. Under the law, technically, it might not fit as a self-defense, but we would say, hey, you look at the totality of it and you say, okay, I can understand why this happened, and it wouldn't be fair if we were to just blindly prosecute this person to the fullest extent of the law, and therefore you reduce it down. The next type of plea bargaining that we do is what I would refer to as a weakness in the case plea bargain. A case that comes to mind in the Oneida County District Attorney's Office involved a young person who was babysitting his son, and the son came up missing for a substantial period of time. We were looking for the child, and ultimately we found the baby at the bottom of the Mohawk River. Now, in that case, personally, I had my thought on what happened, but I had no evidence to prove that. And my opinion might be wrong, and that's not what prosecutors do. We don't prosecute what we think happened. We prosecute what we can prove. So in that case, all we had when it came time to go forward was a deceased child who we had almost no forensic evidence because the child's body had deteriorated in the water. We had a couple statements from the father, none of which implied that it was an intentional murder or an accidental homicide where the father got mad at the child and threw it against the wall or choked it or whatever the case might be. So in that case, we ended up having to take a plea bargain, which even I believed wasn't fair and just, but we were stuck with the fact that we didn't have any evidence. And had we went forward, most likely we would have lost. So we make an offer that we thought was something that we could have proved in court. We weren't going to be able to prove a murder, but we might be able to prove a manslaughter. And we take the manslaughter instead of trying to go forward on a murder case that we didn't feel that we would be able to win. The next type of plea bargaining is when we plea bargain to prevent trauma to our victim. This type of plea bargaining happens a lot in crimes against children, especially sex crimes against children. When we're talking about young children, we're talking about vulnerable people. We're talking about young people that might not stand up well to a grueling cross-examination, especially by an aggressive defense attorney who's pointing out facts that all of us do as children. You know, people lie. People tell their parents things that aren't true. You know, they might lie that they did their homework when they didn't do their homework. They might not tell the truth about numerous things, and a good defense attorney finds out about that, and then they start cross-examining the victim and being very aggressive about it. And depending on the child and how well we think the child will hold up and what's in the child's background, we might make a decision and say, hey, I don't think this is a good idea to put this child through this. The defendant's willing to plead to this. I think that is punishment. I think we're going to get some sort of punishment. We're going to remove this person from the streets, and it might not be for as long as we think we could get, but keeping in mind what's the net result that we would end up with if we put that child on the witness stand, and do we really want to re-traumatize that child or make that child go through a grueling cross-examination. The next type of case that we plea bargain is the case where there's just no jury or judge appeal. Let me just first talk about jury appeal. Jury appeal, most felony cases are tried in front of a jury. And as a result of that, we have to think, how would a jury look at this? What would a jury think? And that kind of goes back to the case where you got the domestic violence case. Jurors are human, and they apply the law to the facts, but they also bring their common sense into the courtroom. So sometimes they do make decisions that if they actually applied the law to the facts, their decision wouldn't be what they ultimately come out of that jury room with. But they use their common sense. And so we have to look at jury appeal. We have to look at, you know, what do we think a jury is going to do in this case? Will a jury be sympathetic to the defendant? Will a jury not like the victim in the case? That happens quite a bit when we're talking about street violence, especially when you have a victim whose past record is that that person has shot 6 or 7 people and just never been prosecuted because they just intimidate all the victims and all the witnesses, and then that person gets shot. We know all that's going to come out, and a jury might say, I don't know, maybe the person kind of got what they had coming. So we have to look at those issues when we make a decision. The next thing we have to look is judge appeal. Generally speaking, like I said, juries, most cases go to a jury, but a defendant can waive his right to a jury and go in front of a judge. That typically happens when you have a legal issue, and the defense, or most of the time it's the defense attorney, talks to the defendant and says, this is more of a legal issue, and I think we want to be in front of a judge. And what ends up happening is we all get to know our judges, and we know that certain judges are going to rule a certain way. So a case that comes to mind is Word of Life. In that case, the presiding judge has a real problem, rightfully so, because of a lot of court decisions on depraved indifference murder. And so in that case, based upon some of the things the judge was saying in chambers and some of the decisions the judge was making and some of the questions that the judge was posing to myself, the defense in that case decided, hey, listen, I think the judge has a problem with depraved indifference murder, and the view of the judge is given of that charge itself, it's going to make it very, very difficult for the prosecution to win, so I'll waive a jury and go in front of a judge. And ultimately, that's what the defense attorney did in that case, and defendant, and they called that one correct because the judge did not find the person guilty of depraved indifference murder. And then the next type of plea bargaining is really no plea bargaining at all. But what happens is the media reports it as a plea offer. But when we don't want to make a plea bargain, we don't want to reduce the charge, we go in and we say plea to the charge, no offer. When that happens, the judge makes the decision on what the sentence would be. We no longer control sentencing. So you can't go in, you can, but we don't have any authority to go in and say, we want you to plead to murder in the second degree and want you to get the maximum punishment. Once we say we want you to plead to the highest count or murder in the second degree or whatever the case might be, the sentence goes up to the court. So now the judge makes the decision, and the judge can decide any range. So for example, if we're talking murder in the second degree, the judge could say, okay, well, I'll sentence you to the minimum, which is 15 to life. Let's change it. We're talking about petty larceny. We might have somebody that has been shoplifting. We've caught this person shoplifting numerous times. They've got 10 convictions, and we can say, plea to the charge, no reduction. We want a year in jail, which is the maximum amount of petty larceny. The court could say it's going to be a $100 fine and a surcharge, and there's nothing we can do to stop that because once we say plea to the charge, it totally goes into the court's hands. But the media, obviously in petty larcenies, those aren't cases that typically make the media, but when you're talking about homicides or vehicular homicides or certain crimes against children or whatever the case might be, the media typically reports that the plea offer, and the public sometimes hears that as a plea bargain, but the plea offer is plea to the charge, no reduction. And I myself have done that on numerous occasions, especially on homicides, homicides of children, where we do have a good case. We just say plea to the charge, sentence up to the court. So I hope that explains it. Plea bargaining, and actually the criminal justice system, is a lot more complicated than just us walking into the court saying, we're not plea bargaining anything, I'm tough on crime, I'm not reducing anything. Put 12 people in the jury box and let's get it on every single case that comes in front of us. It just is not realistic. It is much more complicated than that, as you can see for the different examples I've just given. In addition, if we did do that, in addition to bringing the system to a screeching halt and making it so that most cases wouldn't be tried for 3, 4, 5, 6 years after the arrest, the tax burden would be astronomical. Between witness fees, especially when you're talking about police officers, there would have to be more judges, there would have to be more courtrooms built, and the reality is the bottom line is less people would be held accountable for what the crimes that they committed, because they would not be found guilty. They would be acquitted because of the time that went by, and because the volume of cases that we handled, we would not be able to pay enough attention to each case, or alternatively, an increased taxpayer burden where we'd have to hire more prosecutors. So the way that we do it now, and I think it's a good system, is we look at each case, we make a decision on what we think the right disposition would be, and we proceed with there. There are certain cases we quote-unquote dig in on, and there's other cases we figure, you know, this is the right disposition, and we make an offer to that. I hope that explains plea bargaining and how plea bargaining works, and I hope that for the listeners, I hope that gives you a little bit more insight on what goes on in the criminal justice system. Thank you for listening.